Hello again. This is Carol Bond returning with the Decatur Herald and Review dated September 6th, 2016. We'll begin this half hour with a reading of the obituaries. Kenneth D. Good, 63, of Decatur, passed away from injuries sustained in an accident at 10:19 p.m. Friday, September 2nd. The family will receive friends for a memorial visitation beginning at 5 p.m. until 8 p.m. Wednesday, September 7th at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday morning at the funeral home, with Pastor Steve DeVore and Pastor Dean Kripe co-officiating. Memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Foundation. Nathan L. Reed, 80, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, September 3rd at Decatur Memorial Hospital. There is no additional information about visitation or services. Betty Jane Keller Tyler passed away peacefully on September 2nd at Decatur Memorial Hospital in Decatur. A service to celebrate Betty's new life in Christ will be held at Grace Lutheran Church in Paris, Illinois, on Saturday, September 10th. Visitation will be at 1 o'clock with the service officiated by the Reverend Russ Weiss of St. John's Lutheran Church in Decatur at 2 p.m. Interment will be at Umbra Cemetery in Edgar County following the service. Stuart and Carol Funeral Home is assisting the family with the arrangements. For further information, see the website stuartandcarolfuneralhome.com. I want to return to an earlier obituary. I thought there was no additional information for services for Nathan L. Reed, but I find it pictured, I find it written below an advertisement. So I'm going back to his obituary. He was Nathan L. Reed, 80, of Decatur, who passed away on Saturday at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services to celebrate the life of Nathan Reed will be 6 p.m. Tuesday, September 6th, that's today, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Tuesday before the service at the funeral home. Burial will be 1:30 p.m. Wednesday, September 7th at Graceland Cemetery, with the flight home ceremony following the committal. Memorials may be directed to St. Jude's Children Research Hospital, 501 St. Jude Place, Memphis, Tennessee, 38015. Verna Mae Miller Yoder, 50, of Arthur, passed away at 6:45 p.m. on Friday, September 2nd, in Richland County, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, September 6th, that was today, at the H.C. Key West Building in Arthur. Bishop Daniel Chupp officiated. Burial will be in the Otto Cemetery. Visitation will be anytime after 1 p.m. Sunday, September 4th. I'm sorry, this is over, and also on Monday. There is a report of an accident that has this headline, Accident Claims 2. A Dietrich couple died as a result of a two-car collision Sunday morning on US 40 near the Cumberland County village of Dietrich. Cumberland County Coroner Chuck Layton said an auto driven by David R. Becker, 63, was involved in a crash at 8:23 a.m. Sunday on U.S. 40 with an auto driven by Anita Kemper of Jewett, who was eastbound. Kemper was attempting to turn left off of U.S. 40 onto Cumberland Road into Jewett and collided with Becker's vehicle. Layton said Becker was pronounced dead at the scene at 8:41. The passenger in his vehicle, Portia Becker, 74, was transported to Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana and pronounced dead at 3:43 p.m. Monday. Kemper was sent to St. Anthony's Memorial Hospital in Effingham for treatment. We turn now to the opinions page, where the featured columnist, a column is Students Must Party Less, Study More. As college students head back to school, parents and taxpayers, both groups increasingly subsidizing higher education, rightfully expect these students will work hard to make the most of this significant investment. Unfortunately, data from the American Time Use Survey, conducted by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, indicate otherwise. During the academic year, the average full-time college student spends only 8.3 hours per week in class and 11 hours per week on homework and other education-related activities. By contrast, the average high school student spends 23.9 hours per week in class and 6.3 hours per week on homework and other activities. Considering how little time college students put into their studies, it's no surprise that nationwide, less than 19% of full-time students attending non-flagship public universities and 36% of full-time students attending flagships earn their bachelor's degrees within 4 years. Many aren't even trying to finish in a timely fashion. A study by researchers from Northwestern University suggests, quote, most full-time students do not take the credits necessary to graduate on schedule, opting instead for lighter course loads that put them on 5- and 6-year plans. Many also fall behind by losing credits when transferring and taking remedial coursework. If college students were spending most of their time in college leisurely, graduating in 6 years, but financing their education on their own, the repercussions of this trend would be contained to individuals. However, students are able to borrow up to the full cost of attendance, which includes tuition, fees, room and board, books, and other miscellaneous living expenses. And the federal government now controls 93% of all student loans, 43% of which are either in default or delinquent. Additionally, the Obama administration promulgates legislation that would offer loan forgiveness to students who enter the public sector. Unfortunately, these misguided policies leave taxpayers on the hook for a student's college years, only a fraction of which is spent acquiring skills. Worse, research has shown that increased access to federal aid encourages colleges and universities to raise their tuition prices. So while access to federal aid increases, so do tuition costs, and the time spent working in college remains extremely low. This is a bad deal for American taxpayers. A better option is to restore private lending in the marketplace. We need to rein in the virtually unrestricted access that students have to federal student aid. reversing the incentives for colleges and universities to raise their tuition prices would make it easier for more students to pay for college without government assistance. Once students, rather than American taxpayers, are held financially responsible for their time spent in college, students may spend less time partying and more time studying. That's the featured editorial on the opinions page. We turn now to another column, this one by Jean Phillips, who writes for the Dear Abby letters. Dear Abby, I have been married to my soulmate for 25 years. We get along great. She's my best friend and a good mother to our three kids. She takes care of my mom, who lives with us, too. The only problem is she loves to sleep. She will do anything for us except wake up a few hours early without being mad at the world. She gets our kids off to school with no problem, but then returns to bed. I run a small construction company and need someone to answer the phones and do secretary stuff. Our books are a mess. The house is decent, but she won't let me hire a part-time secretary. She gets up at noon and spends the rest of the day catching up. It's driving a wedge in our marriage. My friends and their wives do things together on weekends, but not mine. She sleeps until 2 or 3 p.m. on the weekends. I work a lot of Saturdays, and when I go to customers' homes and see the wife outside gardening, it breaks my heart. I have threatened to leave, and she works on it for a couple of days and then falls back into the same old habits. Help! Signed, Hurting Husband in California. Dear husband, not everyone requires the same amount of sleep in order to function. Some folks may be fine with 5 hours, but others need 8, 9, or even 10. If your wife needs more than that, there may be an underlying problem of some kind that she should discuss with her doctor. In marriage, there needs to be compromise. If you are experiencing stress because you don't have enough help in your business, then you need to hire someone because your wife is already doing all she can, taking care of three kids and your mother, and you shouldn't need her permission. The next letter has the headline, Compliment Quandary. Dear Abby, at a pool party recently, I complimented another woman on her good figure. She was wearing a bikini and looked great in it, but I was told later by a different woman who had been there how hurtful my compliment had been to everyone else present because I complimented only the bikini-wearing woman. I felt coerced into apologizing to the second woman for not offering a compliment of some kind to everyone else at the party, which seems artificial and unnecessary, actually stupid, to me. The woman looking for the apology left me feeling steamed, and now I'm thinking that maybe I apologized for something I didn't need to. Is it true that you shouldn't compliment one person if you can't manage to do the same for everyone else present? The letter is signed Pool Party Compliment. Dear PPC, no, it's not. I have never heard of that rule of etiquette. Following her logic, you would be compelled to compliment every male at an event if you told one that the tie or shirt he was wearing was nice. I suspect the woman was less hurt than jealous, and I doubt the other women at the pool party were paying much attention to what you said. Right below this letter, Dear Roach, Dr. Roach has a column about sleep, and his headline is Sleep Disturbance and chronic pain are formidable foes. Dear Dr. Roach, several years ago, my doctor told me to start taking Tylenol PM to help me get to sleep at night and to avoid some neuropathy pain. I've been taking 2 before bedtime as directed. Sometimes I awaken after 6 or 7 hours and have to take 2 plain Tylenol to continue my sleep. I was diagnosed with peripheral neuropathy about 3 years ago when I went to the orthopedist with a lower back problem. The back problem was diagnosed as a pinched nerve. At the time, I would wake up during the night with pain from my lower right backside down my right leg and into the right foot. The doctor put me on gabapentin, which I still take. The Tylenol PM helps me get to sleep, and I sleep well for 6 or 7 hours, but some nights I wake up hurting and have trouble getting back to sleep. My concern is the long-term use of the Tylenol PM. Signed, WH. Here's Dr. Roach's answer. Tylenol PM contains acetaminophen, the substance in plain Tylenol, and diphenhydramine, sold as Benadryl, and as many sleep aids. Acetaminophen is a mildly to moderately effective pain reliever, and diphenhydramine is both an antihistamine and a mild sedative for many people. Sleep disturbance is a big problem for many with chronic pain, including pain from neuropathy. Chronic sleep deprivation decreases quality of life and often worsens any perceived pain. Improving sleep is a good goal for people with chronic pain. In general, I try to avoid diphenhydramine because it decreases wakefulness for many people in the morning, described as grogginess. It also increases fall risk and motor vehicle collisions in those who drive. There may be better ways of helping you sleep besides medication. The next question to Dr. Roach involves electrolytes. Dear Dr. Roach, could you explain just what electrolytes are and why they are so important to our bodies? Signed, LDR. Here's his answer. The word electrolyte means that a substance can make water able to conduct electricity because it contains electrically charged particles. In the body, the most important electrolytes are sodium, potassium, magnesium, and calcium, which are positively charged, and chloride, carbonate, and phosphate, which are negative. They are absolutely critical to the function of the body and are regulated to a high degree, mostly through the kidneys, but also through the GI tract. Levels that are too high or too low are life-threatening. They are necessary for muscle and nerve functioning. Our bodies are very good at retaining them, but we do need to obtain them from food. The final letter is about leg cramps. Actually, he writes this letter. I received many letters about a recent column on a cyclist with leg cramps. About half said they were cured by the type of stretching I recommended, while others suggested different remedies, the most frequent of which was magnesium. However, I found several studies that showed magnesium was no better than placebo, except in the case of people who had actual magnesium deficiency. Magnesium deficiency is uncommon, except among people who are taking medications that can reduce the body's magnesium levels, especially diuretics. Fortunately, I heard back from the original reader who told me he hadn't had a single episode of cramping after starting his stretching regimen, which included stretches both before and after riding. I assume that might be bicycle riding, or even it could be riding a stationary bike. Staying on the health topic for a moment, we have an article actually from a website called Aging Care. And this one deals with urinary tract infections in the elderly. It was written by Marlo Solito. Urinary tract infections, UTIs, aren't just a nuisance. They can cause serious health problems. A urinary tract infection happens when bacteria in the bladder or kidney multiplies in the urine. Left untreated, a urinary tract infection can become something more serious than merely a set of uncomfortable symptoms. UTIs can lead to acute or chronic kidney infections, which could permanently damage the kidneys and even lead to kidney failure. UTIs are also a leading cause of sepsis, a potentially life-threatening infection of the bloodstream. The population most likely to experience UTIs is the elderly. Elderly people are more vulnerable to UTIs for many reasons, not the least of which is their overall susceptibility to all infections due to the suppressed immune system that comes with age and certain age-related conditions, according to the National Institutes of Health, NIH. Younger people tend to empty the bladder completely upon urination, which helps to keep bacteria from accumulating within the bladder. But elderly men and women experience a weakening of the muscles of the bladder, which leads to more urine being retained in the bladder, poor bladder emptying, and incontinence, which can lead to UTIs. The typical signs and symptoms of a UTI include urine that appears cloudy, bloody urine, strong or foul-smelling urine odor, frequent or urgent need to urinate, pain or burning with urination, pressure in the lower pelvis, low-grade fever, night sweats, shaking, or chills. Elderly people with serious urinary tract infection don't exhibit the hallmark sign of fever because their immune system is unable to mount a response to infection due to the effects of aging. In fact, elders often don't exhibit any of the common symptoms or don't express them to their caregivers. UTIs in the elderly are often mistaken as the early stages of dementia or Alzheimer's, according to NIH, because symptoms include confusion or delirium-like state, agitation, hallucinations, other behavioral changes, poor motor skills or dizziness, falling. Sometimes these are the only symptoms of a UTI that show up in the elderly. No pain, no fever, no other typical symptoms of a UTI. Why do the elderly develop UTIs? According to NIH, the following conditions make the elderly more susceptible to UTIs. Diabetes, urinary retention, unable to empty the bladder even if your loved one has just used the bathroom, use of a urinary catheter, bowel incontinence, enlarged prostate, immobility, For example, those who must lie in bed for extended periods of time. Surgery of any area around the bladder. Kidney stones. People with incontinence are more at risk for UTIs because of the close contact that adult briefs have with their skin, which can reintroduce bacteria into the bladder. Some recommendations to help reduce this risk include the following: change the briefs frequently, encourage front-to-back cleansing, keep the genital area clean. Set reminders or timers for those who are memory impaired to try to use the bathroom instead of the adult brief. Other way to reduce the chances of UTIs: drink plenty of fluids, 2 to 4 quarts each day. Drink cranberry juice or use cranberry tablets, but not if your elder has personal or family history of kidney stones. Avoid caffeine and alcohol because these irritate the bladder. Do not douche or use other feminine hygiene products. Always wipe from front to back for women. Wear cotton cloth underwear and change them at least once a day. If you think your elderly parent might have a urinary tract infection, see your doctor right away. We turn now to an article from the AARP Bulletin. It involves end-of-life discussions. Though nearly all doctors agree that they should talk with patients about their preferences for end-of-life care, most find it hard to start the conversation, and many aren't sure what to say, according to a nationwide poll. Some three-quarters of doctors and specialists believe the likelihood of these discussions is increased by Medicare's decision to begin reimbursing them $86 for talking with patients about such things as hospice care, do not resuscitate orders and living wills. And three-quarters also say they should initiate the talk, but only 14% have billed Medicare for it. Almost half of the physicians said they are frequently or sometimes unsure of what to say, concerned the patient might give up hope, concerned the patient might feel the doctor was giving up on them. Studies have indicated that patients increasingly want discussions before facing a terminal illness. Some policy experts say end-of-life conversations save money on aggressive medical interventions that are not proven to prolong life and that many patients and their families don't want. The survey was commissioned by the John A. Hartford Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, and Cambia Health Foundation. This has been Carol Bond with the Decatur Herald Review dated September 6, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again next week.